Mark, what did one Catholic priest say to the other when they visited the orphanage?
I do not like where this is going.
Let us pray.
That's not as dark as I thought you were going to go, to be honest.
No, we're going to get in trouble on this episode.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, well. Hello, welcome to Horror Movie Review. I'm going to put my teeth back in. That's great for new listeners. I'm not even editing that out. Hello and welcome to the You Run podcast, the Horror Movie Review wing of the asylum. Your doctors today are me, Scott.
And me, Mark.
If you've never listened before, we're an interactive horror movie review show run and controlled by the listeners. And if that sounds like your particular brand of insanity, then check in for treatment at You Run Podcast on any social media. We're on all of them. If you are a crazy stalker and have crazy behavior, you need to follow my lovely co-host Mark, Reviews from the Crypt or VHS from the Crypt on Instagram. He also has some reviews and some really great VHS collector content as well. So, yeah, he's open to stalkers and proper followers as well.
No, just the proper followers will do, thank you.
If you have a lot to say about a movie or anything we've said, which I think this episode will probably generate some interest, yourunpodcast@gmail.com, drop us an email and we'll read it on the air. If you want to hear your voice echo through the asylum, then record us a voicemail. You can do that by recording an audio DM on any social media that will allow it. If there's a microphone button there, push and hold it, speak, and that'll get played on the air. We don't have any this week, so we're going to dive straight in.
No problem.
Happy with that?
Just out of curiosity, this asylum thing that you're rolling with at the moment, is this going anywhere or...?
No, it just kind of... It's the mindset I was in when I was writing this episode.
Right, okay. No, that's cool. We'll go with it.
Yeah, that's it now. It's done.
Oh, right. Okay.
This is Paranormal Week. We gave you a long list of movies to pick between. And for those of you who don't already follow us on Instagram, when there is a tie, I introduce a wild card movie to replace the two movies that drew. The first time ever in all the time we've done this show, we had a wild card final. And I don't know if it's because the options I gave were so great that you couldn't pick between them, or they were just so terrible that you couldn't pick between them.
But, what were the against, just out of curiosity? Because I'd kind of like to know what I could have won in terms of movies this week.
You could have won loads this week. We had Sinister in there. We had, what else do we have in there? Poltergeist 2. There was loads. Paranormal Activity was in there, number two. There was loads in there this week. And yeah, all of the ones I put in all got kicked out. Today, we look at a battle of faith and science as a priest faces prison time for interfering with a girl. Not those normal tastes, but hey. Demonic Possession, based on real life events, starring Tom Wilkinson and Jennifer Carpenter. Today, we are walking you through The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
I don't care about my reputation. What I care about is telling Emily Rose's story.
Holy Church venerates thee as her guardian and protector. To thee, the Lord has entrusted the souls of the redeemed to be led into heaven. Pray therefore the God of peace to crush Satan beneath our feet, that we may retain life by thy feet.
Do you understand how long they can put you away for this?
I want people to hear what only I can tell.
And what is that?
What really happened to Emily and why?
So she believed that her actual possession began that night at the hospital?
I think she did.
Emily had epilepsy. Father Moore's beliefs are based on superstition.
Did Father Moore ask you to give her any medical help?
I couldn't help her.
Why couldn't you help her?
Because there are no injections against the devil.
Emily?
Can you hear me?
Demons exist whether you believe in them or not. Just be careful, Aaron. There are forces surrounding this trial. Emily, can you hear me?
The trailer shows a lot.
Everything by the looks of that trailer.
Listeners score the movies. The listeners have scored this a 4.5 out of 5. Letterboxd have scored this a 3 out of 5. And Google coming in at a 4.3 out of 5. A bit of synopsis for anyone who hasn't seen it, who wants to listen. A Catholic priest performs an exorcism on an allegedly possessed girl. During the rites, the girl died, landing the priest in hot waters with the court. Charged with negligent homicide, it's the up to the priest to prove to the prosecution that the jury and the jury that he was in fact fighting the forces of evil and not just being an asshole to a mentally ill teenager. This is a spoiler heavy show. We say it every single week, and here is your spoiler warning.
Okay, I'm going to explain this shit to you like you're 5. Get your eyes checked, read the damn episode title. I don't want to hear any bitching, any complaining about how, oh, there's spoilers. No, read it. If you've not seen it, do not listen. Okay, I'm going to explain this shit to you like you're 5. Get your...
Heather's telling us twice again. Apologies, everyone. I still haven't quite mastered this new service we're on. And I'm not editing now. I don't know if anyone's realized this, but I'm not editing anything. So what you get is just raw episode. It's just raw us now.
Oh, that's dangerous, is it not? Especially on an episode dealing with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and I think now is a good time to remind existing listeners and tell new listeners that I was raised Catholic. So I am a confirmed Catholic. I've done everything I needed to do to become a full Catholic. And I am in a position to bash the shit out of the religion that I grew up in because I understand it really, really well. So I will do that on this episode heavily.
I am not religious. I didn't grow up religious, but I just don't give a fuck. So I'm and you... taking this down as best I can.
I'm going to give a bit of context to this movie before we start the run through. So the movie is presented to us in sections of the past and sections of the present. A president? Present. And it cuts between... It's going to be a
bad
day.
You sure you don't want to edit this, mate?
No, I'm going to leave it in. But it cuts between the past and the present a lot. And it flashes back multiple times, backwards and forwards, within a single scene. Because of this, giving you kind of a full run through in a traditional sense is almost impossible. And it won't translate very well. It'll be very, very choppy and hard to follow. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you the kind of run through. We're going to miss some bits and then we're going to circle back on things that we've missed. And the conversation's going to go all over the place on this episode. The movie opens with a man arriving at a large house somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Instantly, great setting. This is very Halloween 4 opening. It starts with pumpkins and a misty field. I was like, it's H4.
Yeah, I like this opening. I got genuinely excited for this as well at the beginning because it is set up really well in that creepy, eerie way. I mean, you see Father Badman sticking his head around the doorway of the window. As we sort of allude through the fog and pass the rotting pumpkins on the floor, and it looks cool. It looks cool, and it sets a good precedent for the start of the movie, I think. But
yeah, it does. So the guy who's arriving at the house is the medical examiner, and he's eventually let in after no one coming to the door immediately. I love when he comes in that they show the family are in that sort of downstairs living room, and they're all in distress, so much so that he says hi to the dad, and the dad just doesn't even acknowledge that he exists.
No. Was I not the only one who was concerned at how slow this dude was walking? It literally took him about 15 minutes to walk through the living room and up the stairs.
Yeah, the medical examiner's not got much time left on this earth. When he gets upstairs, we have a meeting with the priest. So the priest comes out of the bedroom, who's Father Moore, as the medical examiner is going in, and they have this meeting in the hallway. I love this pretext of setting up that this is a religious versus scientific battle, and they do it in a split second. I think it's great.
Yeah, just with a look between the two of them.
Yeah, the medical examiner looks at him like, oh, so you're the religious nut. And he looks at the medical examiner like, oh, you're the doctor, are you? It's great. Yeah. After a little while, the medical examiner comes down and he says, like, I can't confirm this is natural causes that's killed this girl. And instantly, the policeman goes, Father, you're going to have to come with us and arrest him.
Rightly so, though. Rightly so. In this moment, I was like, exactly, that is how it should be done in this situation.
Like, and
I'm not a skeptical type of person, but like when it comes to stuff like this and somebody dies at the hand of voodoo, in essence, somebody's got to be culpable for it.
Yeah, 100%. And in this, it's the only movie I've seen that does this. I've seen so many exorcism movies where it all goes horribly wrong and the police turn up and go, oh, did that not go well? Never mind, Father. Back to church for you.
And it's just this thing of like religion being above the law in some sort of way. And it's like, where do you draw the line? Because he's a religious zealot, like that's okay. He's all right to have this young girl die at his hands because he speaks the word of God. I mean, come on, man. Like if this was some normal, any other sort of religious practice that delves into exorcisms, which I know a lot of religious practices out there do, they all have their every own religion variation.
Every religion on earth exactly. has a form of exorcism.
But say if you were a certain type of religion that dealt with this kind of stuff away from the Catholic Church, if the police come in and found somebody dead in your house at the hands of some sort of exorcism, you would immediately be taken away by the police and questioned. But 9 times out of 10 in these movies, when it's done by the Catholic Church, it's like, it's a proper exorcism, so it's okay.
Yeah, well, the Catholic Church are one of the biggest businesses on the planet, so they've got a bit of sway with courts and governments and other things. Father Moore is arrested and he's charged with negligent homicide. And we now go into meeting the legal teams. And again, I really like how this is done. So first we see the prosecution team and they're deciding who they're going to get who's actually going to be the prosecutor in the court. And they choose Ethan Thomas because he's a religious man. He's not Catholic, but he goes to church all the time and he understands it inside and out. And then for defense, they choose Erin Bruner, who is an agnostic and also a badass. She is so fucking... She reminds me of Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs.
She like does, yeah, Jodie but Foster... she is very bad at her job. She is a terrible, terrible defense lawyer.
She's just won a massive case and got a convicted or a drug felon off of a murder charge who's now sitting on a beach in California. I would disagree with your assessment.
No, because the thing is as well with that, like this, we're going to jump around because I'm going to have to now to back this point up. They spend so much time focusing on introducing that she got this murderer. He was a murderer. She got him off through defense. And then in about an hour's time into the movie, we find on the news bulletin that he'd gone on a murdering spree and killed like 2 women and a child. I was like, this is what I mean. You're a bad person. But not only that, she is terrible at her job. There is so many stuff throughout this court case that she overlooks or doesn't dive into. I think there's one, I'm sure we'll get into it, so I'm going to save it and I'll spring it on you when I need to. But this stuff she does throughout this court case. And I'm like, you should have known that, or you should have checked that before you walked into this courtroom. And you should have also been on time.
The on-time one bugged me, really bugged me. But we'll get there. The bar that she's in is called the Sidebar. I laughed at that. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Really cool. She visits Father Moore in his prison cell, and he's like, look, I want to testify. I want to testify and I want to tell Emily's story. And she's already been told in the bar by her boss, under no circumstances put Father Moore on the stand. And she lies to Father Moore and goes, yeah. Yeah, okay, that's fine. You can tell your story.
I missed the first time he said to her. He
told her right at the very beginning, I'm giving you this case, do not put him on the stand because the church do not want to see him on the stand talking shit about the church.
Yeah, right, okay, that's it. I missed that first time around then, because his whole selling point of accepting her as his defense lawyer was that he gets to speak up and tell his story.
Yeah, but she had already been told no, and she just went, yeah, I'll be fine. Yeah, we'll do that for you. And he's not willing to take a plea bargain. So he's been offered a plea bargain where he will get the sentence reduced, and it'll be basically he'll get a slap on the wrist and be let go. It'll be, not homicide. It'll be something else, a lesser charge. And he's not willing to take that.
Can you remember what his reasoning for? Why did he turn that down? I can't remember now. He said something really.
Because if he'd done that, he wouldn't get the chance to tell Emily's story.
Right, okay.
Which, yeah, just take the lesser charge and then write a book and tell Emily's story that way.
Yeah, but he'd have still done 6 months, wouldn't he? I think that's what they're offering him, 6 months in prison. Yeah,
but six and months
would that
is
have
better.
Stripped him of his... Would he be renounced from the church then for that?
Oh, 100%. What,
if you've done a bit of
accidentally that. Kill... Yeah, I think you're not coming out with prison tattoos and then going to your congregation the following week.
So you're going to say, oh, yeah, if you've killed a girl, then you get renounced from your church. But I don't think they would. I don't think... No. Had he not even gone to court for this, they wouldn't have even batted an eyelid at it. It's only because it drew so much media attention and focus, which is why you're probably in hot water with the Catholic Church.
Yeah, exactly that. And you're going to get really annoyed later when we talk about facts and I talk about actual exorcisms for the Catholic Church. She's going to really wind you up. So I'm saving that. I'm quite excited for that. She also goes and visits Emily's mum. And this is really sad. Emily's mum is just... I don't want to call her a religious nut, but she's a religious nut.
Yeah.
She's like, yes, we had complete faith in Father Moore, and it irritated me. I like the lawyer-to-lawyer meeting. So you get Ethan Thomas goes to see Aaron Bruner in the bar, and he's like, look, I'm going to offer you a better deal because the DA doesn't think this is a good idea for it to go. To try a man of God is not something they want to do. It's not a good look for the US government. And she's like, well, he's innocent and there's not going to be any plea bargain. He's like, have you seen the autopsy photos? And she just pauses because she hasn't. And that instantly I went, why have you not seen the autopsy photos?
No. And she still doesn't by the time they go to court, because they show them in court and she looks absolutely gobsmacked by them. And I'm like, how have you not seen this already? Surely that would be one of the first things you would see within the big, massive amount of files on your desk.
Yeah, but she spends all her time in the sidebar drinking martinis.
Oh, yeah, because she's a hip city lawyer.
She is. When we get the meeting with the mum, we also get a flashback to Emily at college and just her generally being happy. And it's when she gets her acceptance letter and she's bouncing around the room. And I've got to say, the actress who plays her is incredible in this movie. I think her acting and her performance as standard Emily and possessed Emily's outstanding.
Yeah, she's great. Jennifer Carpenter, she's called, you'd probably know her most famously from being Dexter's sister.
Debbie Morgan, yeah.
Debbie. She's great. I like her a lot. I loved her in Dexter. I really liked her in this. I don't know whether this was like pre-Dexter or not.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so this was like one of her first roles, I think. And she looks really young in here, but she does a fantastic job. Really, really good. Especially some of the more physically demanding stuff that she does later on in the movie was fantastic from her.
Yeah, really good. Trial begins and the prosecution parade out a selection of medical experts explaining that Emily was epileptic. And not only was she epileptic, but she was suffering with a type of psychosis. And with those two combined, it would mimic the traits of being possessed. Now, they jump between the past and the trial is genius. So the way they do this, I think, is so clever. So they put someone on the stand who will start talking through the events of what led Emily to come to them after she had her first outburst. And as they start talking, it will fade into the scene and you actually see Emily do it. And I think that is fabulous. Then it fades back to the witness stand as that witness finishes their testimony. And then they swap it out with another witness and rinse and repeat. I think it's a great way of doing the past and the present.
Yeah, it's a great storytelling narrative. But I mean, it's not that unique to courtroom dramas. A lot of courtroom dramas and stuff like that do follow this sort of suit. But it does transition well to screen, especially when you're dealing with the aftermath of an event rather than showcasing the full event and then going into the court. It sets the pacing quite nicely to bounce between the two, I think.
Yeah. They kick off the possession really well. So one of my biggest problems with The Exorcist Believer was the lack of build to the actual possession. And this movie does this right. So to start off with, she's tormented. She's woken up at 3 a.m. by the smell of burning in the hall. She goes out and then you see doors slam in. And it's really cool that she's tormented. She's fine. She's a normal girl and this demon's decided to torment her. And that's the first bit where it's basically punishing her. And then
what's the relevance with 3 o'clock in the morning? Because I know you'll probably know this.
Yeah, so 3 a.m. in the morning is the demonic witching hour. It's meant to be mocking the Holy Trinity because it's 3. And also it's the exact opposite time of the time that Christ died. He died at 3 p.m.
Right, okay.
So it's meant to be the polar opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, it has massive significance throughout this film, so I knew there must have been some sort of meaning behind it.
Yeah. The demon attempted rape was a bit much. The special effects were good. I thought the visual effects on the bed depressing as the demon comes into her room and she's basically pinned to the bed by an invisible force. I thought all of this looked really good.
See, the interesting thing about this, I even texted you and messaged you while I was watching it. I was like, oh, right, okay, this is cool, because my perspective of this was that she'd been sexually assaulted. She'd gone away to her college and she'd been raped. And this was just her. Do you know how trauma victims tend to block
manifest
out events
it.
And things like that? Yeah, and manifest it in a certain way. So I was like, oh, this is quite cool, actually. This is what it's going to be. It's going to turn out she's had sexual assault and then she's suffering severe mental trauma from the horrific event she's ensued at college. And then it's going to bleed into the church getting involved. And instead of it being an actual mental illness that she's suffering from, they're going to try and cure it with religion. And that's why he's being done for negligence and so forth and so forth. That would have been an excellent route to take this down. Obviously, it's a very traumatic route to take it down when you're dealing with sexual assault. But I feel like that would have been a very cool way to play this story out.
Yeah, it would have done. And it's a very cool way to play this anyway, because at no point, even in at any point in this movie, do they tell you conclusively whether it was a mental illness or whether it was demonic possession. And they leave it completely open to your interpretation to decide what you think.
Do you think, though?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, you could quite easily look at this movie and say that she's mentally ill, which is where I sit with it.
Yeah, but you could do that. But then they show so much influence on everybody else involved in the story, with the defense attorney waking up at 3 o'clock and smelling smoke in her apartment. You've got the medical doctor who was there who starts hearing voices and then gets hit by the car. All of these things culminate together to sort of back the idea that it is. And you can't put all of those things down to freak coincidence.
Of course you can.
Because if you take them apart, you can't, because they're so heavily affected by the story that the father's trying to tell. Everything is too point perfect with the time in the morning, the smelling of the smoke. All of these things, you can't just say, oh, well, it's weird that you're feeling all these things the same way that she felt all of these things and the doctor's feeling all these things, when none of them were in... Because this is all set post-exorcism. This is all after. So it's not... You can't. The film, the movie itself works too hard to tell you that it is an exorcism.
Yeah, which is why I dig my heels in and say it's not.
I want to believe you, and I think you could be right, and that would be a better perspective to have, and it would have been a more intelligent way to play the movie. But that's, like I say, a fault of the film. They push too much on the possession side of things with everybody else involved. That you can't ignore those things in order to make your own story work better for yourself, which is what I wanted to do, because the theory I had at the beginning was miles better than the way this film plays out. But there's just too much evidence against it for it to be for that to be justified.
What do you think of, like, as you hear the testimony, we're flashing back to Emily, where you see, like, the face in the window and the, like, melted, like, the demonic, like, black hole eyes on the people. What did you think of all of that? Do you think that looks good, or is that dated, or where are you, like, the thing on the window.
This was early 2000s, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the thing on the window where you get the demonic face and the flash of lightning through, I thought that looked amazing.
In the clouds and stuff.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
But then,
brilliant.
But when
then
it goes to...
was like a Snapchat Snapchat filter kind of stuff. And that was, considering that was literally the only real CGI effects throughout, apart from a couple of storms later on, the use of that was, I felt, could have been done a lot better.
Yeah, I think you're right with that. Because
it's too late on in the day for me to give it a pass saying that it's a product of its time with the CGI, because there is many films out there that do a similar sort of thing as this and do it a lot better. A hell of a lot better than what this is. And I know we only get quick flashes on screen of them, but for me, it just felt very cheap. But when you do see those early stuff, though, where she is being taunted and you see it in the rain and you see it on the glass and you see it in the clouds, that's great. It's when you see that first kid turn on her in school. Like, oh, here we go. Here we go then.
Yeah. It's that one step too far.
And it's so overplayed within quick succession of that scene where she's running out of school as well for me, which was like, all right, okay, now tone it back a little bit because you're kind of ruining it.
Yeah. So you get, she turns in, she sees the thing in the cloud. She turns around. The classmate's got the demonic eyes. She runs out of the classroom, out into the rain. She runs past a couple. They've got it. She turns and looks in a car window. They've got it. She looks up the path and there's another one who's got it. It's like, ugh.
She runs into a church and the two old ladies in the church, they've got it. And it's like,
I forgot about the ladies.
Once
in
or
the church.
Twice would have been enough, but it was like you get about 10 different people with the same terrible effects within about probably 90 seconds. And for me, I was like, oh, God.
Yeah. See, the way I'd have done it would have been the boy in the classroom and the two old ladies in the church when she thought she was safe. I'd have left the bits in the middle out and not done that.
Yeah, me too. That would have been perfect.
Yeah.
But as well, with stuff like this, when you do things like that, you then need to show the reactions of the people who she thinks are possessed, for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
because
like,
they should freak out. Like...
And then they should be like, oh, holy shit, what's going on? Are you okay? Are you okay? Trying to comfort her while they're, you see the two perspectives against each other, but you don't. You just see her running down the street seeing poor CGI faces, and it's just like, oh, that's just loads.
To be fair, though, her reaction to poor CGI is almost exactly the same as yours. High-pitched scream like Ned Flanders.
So in that sense, I guess it is kind of believable, yeah.
It's this scene that leads her to bumping into one of her friends at uni, and he comes to her room and basically stays the night with her to try and calm her down. And we get one of the most horrific contortion scenes in any horror movie. I love this. He wakes up and she's gone, and she's on the floor, and she is bent in a position that a person should not bend in. And he gets closer and closer, and her eyes are black, and she just does this like blood-curdling scream. And it's so good. Like, that in itself, just that one bit is terrifying.
And for me, this is the best bit of the film, is the contortionist elements of it. It's so cool, so effective. Again, back in the original Exorcist, my favorite scene in that is the spider walk down the stairs, which was actually cut from the original version of the movie. There's a lot. Most times when you're watching it on streaming services, that scene in particular is cut. There's not many cuts of it out there where you actually get to see that. And it's one of the most iconic scenes in the film. Again, with this, rather than going down the whole floating and all the rest of it, because they do it in a way where they can justify the contortionism, because it's she has seizures. And then when they're in court, again, we're bouncing back and forth. When they're in court, they explain that the medical side to it is a seizure and it causes her body to lock up into these positions.
Yeah, it also causes her pupils to dilate and appear black because they're dilated fully and there's no colour, which, again, works. It's great.
Is this medically factual? Have you looked into this?
Yeah, so there are conditions when you have a seizure that your pupils will fully dilate and your eyes will effectively look black because all the colour will be gone. You're just a pupil as big as it can go.
Wow. All right, that's even scarier. But yeah, like I said, that for me was like the best part of it, was the way that they do that. The second one's my favourite, and I've got a lot to say about that when we get there, but I'll wait till
I've got a whole section on facts about the contortion because it's incredible how it's done. We find out now that Emily was under treatment. So when she had her first, this moment where she's gone and all contorted and weird, she was getting treatment and she was being prescribed drugs to help with the seizures and help with the visions. But they weren't really doing a lot because she was had those before she had the full, like, twisted body, twisted metal moment.
Yeah.
And after that, the dad, so the boy who stayed the night with her, rung her dad. And her dad's like, look, just bring her home. Bring her home and we'll sort it out. They left her at home for a couple of days to see if things got better. And it didn't. So, like all God-fearing religious crazy people, they reached out to their priest as opposed to a doctor.
Yeah, but the doctor was involved before. This is where it went. This is where it got quite cloudy for me, because she was under medical care first, was she not? We don't get a great sense of time frame when this started.
Yeah, so she was under medical care. She was under medical care, but that was the doctors at the university who were treating her as a patient.
So all
there,
these doctors that we get in the court, they're all university doctors.
They're all university doctors who are at her university who are going, oh, well, I can treat you. I'm qualified. There's take some medication, take some antipsychotics. You'll be fine.
Like they call it. Yeah. Did the seizures start? Is she something she's always suffered with, or did this start when she got to college?
Started when she got to uni. So when she was at home, the opening segments with the mum, she's like, she was a happy kid. She had no problems at all until she went to university.
Right. Okay. Again, I miss quite a lot because this is a
it's not a snooze fest. Where are you at the moment? So when you're at this point of the movie, are you demonic possession or are you mental illness?
I'm still well against the church. I always am in these possession movies. I'm always trying to find some way of looking at it from a different perspective, which is why I was so excited about this movie in particular, because that's the whole end game of it, in a sense, is to try and make you look at it from a different angle, and what is the outsider's perspective on something that is as ludicrous as exorcisms. So I was still with my whole sexual assault theory up until this point.
Now back in, Erin Bruner realizes she is losing the case. They're being torn apart by medical professionals. She's also having her own problems, where she wakes up at 3 a.m. she smells burning, she gets a couple of bumps and bangs, and like you,
She does do her first wake up at the 3 a.m. and they can't translate on screen that she smells burning. So the only thing they can do is have her sniff and then cut away to a smoke alarm. I was like, that is brilliant.
It's clever though, because you got it.
I got it, yeah, but I got it in like a laughable way. I was like, oh, come on.
She makes the decision that they can't refute the medical evidence. It's too strong. So she's going to go down another option, which is to push the option that the possession and the exorcism is a real and scientifically measurable thing. And she calls Dr. Sadri Adani to the stand. I love her. And I love her testimony as well, because her testimony is based in real world fact. This is something I did look at. So she testifies that every faith across the world has forms of exorcism. And she has studied these all across the world. And basically she gives scientific evidence based on statistics that this amount of people globally across every single faith statistically cannot be wrong.
No.
It's measurable and studyable. Granted, lots of them have mental illnesses, but she didn't think that was the case in Emily. And I really like the fact that she doesn't just go, they don't try to do anything really hokey here, where she tries to say, well, they're real because I've seen a ghost. They didn't do anything like that. It was based purely on statistics, which is cool.
Yeah, which is excellent. And for me, she should be the leader of a church, because I would go to church if they based their religious theories around scientific evidence, because I'm a man of science. And the way this woman spoke about these exorcisms and possessions and all the voodoo stuff she was talking about, she had scientific knowledge that backed up her theories to a certain degree. Obviously, you have to take a certain leap of logic and in areas, but there was enough scientific knowledge behind what she was saying. I was so engrossed in everything she said while she was on the stand. I was like, you are fucking cool, man. I was like, everything you are saying is brilliant.
And she's really bitey and really feisty as well. So when the prosecution gets up to cross-examine her, he basically calls her a witch doctor in not so many words.
And she hits her. He's like, so you've been all over the country, you've seen all these voodoos and ghost witches, and I can't remember what she said. I can't remember her exact words, what she said to him.
She just shot him down immediately. Yeah, she starts with, well, ignoring the level of hostility and amount of digs you had at me, I'm now going to answer you with a scientific fact. Fuck you. Yeah. It's kind of how it ended.
And his face just dropped. And I was like, yeah, fuck you too, man.
I'm going to burn my fact about exorcisms now. So exorcism is on the rise across the globe. In 2018, the Vatican extended its exorcism program to take on 250 more priests from 50 countries purely to be trained in exorcism only. Exorcism specialists.
Isn't that crazy that mental health is the highest it's ever been, and so is exorcisms?
Ooh. Yeah. Exact numbers are sketchy. How many exorcisms do you think are allegedly performed globally in a year?
Allegedly performed or allegedly real?
Allegedly performed. We're not going with real. I believe in mental illness. I don't believe in demonic entities possessing me.
No, that's okay then. I reckon it is absolutely mental, especially within, like, I would say more so heavily Catholic states, such as maybe in Italy. Quite a lot of European countries, I would have said, would heavily focus upon things like this. I'm going to say it's well into its thousands, probably even maybe tens of thousands.
It is into thousands. There are roughly 7,000 estimated exorcisms that happen each year. Only a small handful of these, less than 100, are performed and approved by the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church, although
they all have to be approved.
Only in the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church only perform a couple of hundred, but religions across the world perform thousands.
Right.
But the Catholic Church only do a small amount that are there. Exorcisms, but other religions do a lot more. When you get into places like Mexico and Colombia, there's a lot of exorcism that happens in Colombia and especially Mexico as well.
Yeah, they're crazy, man. They are real crazy. Well, at least I say they're really crazy. I don't know these people. I'm not sure how crazy they actually are, but the way they are translated on TV and film, they are mental.
Well, a lot of Mexicans fight really hard to get into the United States, so I would say they are certifiable.
Yeah.
Erin has not put Father Moore on the stand, and she's not in any rush to. Because they have
just to be clear as well, I wasn't saying that Mexicans are mental. I don't want to get cancelled for calling out Mexicans being mental. I was just saying, like, the religious cult aspect of, like, countries such as Mexico and Cuba and things like that is mental.
You clearly said Mexicans, and then I doubled down for you and said they want to get into the United States. So I'm with you.
It took me a while to click on to why you were going on about getting into the United States. I was like, no, I don't mean Mexicans in general.
Yeah, and I'm going to say hello because we actually have a 2% listenership in Mexico. So, hello.
Yeah, arriba.
Oh, dear God.
Arriba?
I don't think that was Speedy Gonzalez. Jesus. So she was not going to put him on the stand, and a medical witness come forward. And this was a doctor who was actually at the exorcism, and she blows her stack at the priest, like, why didn't you tell me? He's like, he asked me to promise not to. He didn't want to get involved, so I didn't break his confidence. That's kind of the whole fucking deal of a priest. He confided in me that he didn't want to be part of it, so I didn't make him part of it. And he's come
forward. Such an honourable man.
Yeah, he is. So the Doctor's come forward himself to help out his friend, the priest. He also meets with Erin and he hands her a recorder. And this is the recording of the actual exorcism. And they have a bit of back and forth. And he's like, look, there was nothing I could do for this girl. But medical treatment wasn't going to help. And then when he gives her the recording, he's like, also, this is your burden now. I don't need it. I'm going home.
Yeah.
Which makes you instantly go, how bad is that tape?
And also, what is he also experiencing? Because we find out later on that he is experiencing things. And he's trying to just rid himself of all content of it.
Yeah. Now, Father Moore does take the stand. And the reason he takes the stand is because the next day, as they're about to start for trial, the Doctor does not arrive. He's not there. No, sorry, he takes the stand before. She's going to put him on the stand because she's got the Doctor as a witness. Yeah, so he can say things.
She could he could validate everything that the father was saying because he was there for the exorcism. So not only do they have a religious perspective, they also then have a medical perspective as well to be able to back
that
up
backs it up. Yeah. His testimony takes us to more flashbacks where Emily is now possessed at her home. Her jumping and clawing at the wall, I thought was fabulous when she first met
Spider-Man.
Yeah, lots. And it's really slowly done and they really focus on it. And I smile.
Oh, the legs were like hanging out the side of her mouth. I'm like, Minga, get away.
And she meets the priest and she meets the Doctor at this moment. And she goes into speaking in foreign languages. And then she just like fixes dead rigid. Like on the floor. Amazing. She seizes on the floor and fixes rigid and they stand her up like she's frozen in ice. It's so cool.
Do you know what's so cool about this, which is something you may have even missed? The best part about this entire contortionist scene here, where they lift her up and she's frozen like solid.
Yeah.
Her hair is frozen like solid as well, which I thought was such an incredible little detail. And it was a blink and you miss it kind of thing. She, as they lift her up, her hair... It's like they laid her down and then just covered her in hairspray. And then she is literally a full statue. Her hair doesn't flop or wave or blow. It is just stuck in the position it was on the floor. And even when she then turns and looks her head and says whatever she says, her hair is like frozen, stuck, like floating up. I was like, whoa, that is so cool.
Yeah, so when they stand her back up, and it is really cool, but when they stand her back up, she turns to the priest and basically says to him, you think you can take me out of this girl? Give it your best shot, old man. It's like, oh, a demon that's spicy. Like, really, like, fucking, you want to do this, priest? Bring it. I'm ready. And I love this movie, and I know you don't.
Yeah.
But I really love this movie. Father Moore explains that he had permission from the Archdiocese and from the family, and most importantly, Emily, to perform the rite of exorcism. And he clearly states on the stand that without all of those people saying yes, this doesn't go ahead. Which then leads you
to my mind the level of damage that this process causes. And as a parent myself, I could never consent to something like this, regardless of how dedicated I was to the church. It's just insane to me that these people allow this to happen. And this happens in real life. Like, people go through this. This is based on a real case, which is 20, if not 50 times more horrific than it's depicted in this movie, which we'll get to at the end. Regardless whether you get to it in facts or I get to it in my roundup, we will talk about the real case of this movie later on. And it's just insane to me on so many levels that people will validate this process and allow it to happen, especially to their loved ones and their children. It's just insane to me. It really is.
Yeah, it is to me as well. I mean, mental health issues can be treated with various medications and therapy and lots of other things. And a priest 100% can help with the therapy process alongside drugs. If you are a religious person, a religious influence into your life that you believe in that thing, that's a good thing if you're in some sort of recovery, when it's doubled up with medical care, not when he's there sticking a cross on your head and trying to cast out demons. I don't think that helps.
No, No, and I'm not really, and as much as I'm going against the church on this, I'm also not a big advocate for medical care either. I don't believe in drugs being the answer to anything. You know, like if you have mental problems and mental issues, the best thing to do is to talk about them and get them out and seek therapy. Therapy is the best possible outcome for most of these situations. Numbing your body with drugs does not help the problem. It only hides it. So like,
yeah,
for me, this is just a whole big mess of people influencing things in such a wrong way, whether that be via numbing it through drugs or witching our processes that they go through. It's just, it, honestly, the whole thing just annoyed me all the way through. There was nobody I liked in this movie.
Aaron hands him the tape recorder and gets him to play it. And as he pushes play, we get the exorcism. We also get the best scene in a barn in all of horror, but I'll get to that in a minute. It starts in the bedroom with Emily, and she's being tied to the bed. She's being doused with holy water. When he douses her with holy water, all of a sudden the demon is there and she's bolt upright and full attention to like, oh, okay, it's now then, we're going to do this. They begin the rite and the demon gets angry and gets free and smashes Emily's dad in the head, then breaks free completely and jumps out the window like fucking Blade.
Are you forgetting the whole reason how she managed to escape? By bringing in three cats to distract the father. I mean, this was like something like a Scary Movie too, man. These three cats come bursting in the door and just automatically pounce on Father McDonald,
There were six cats.
Oh, let me guess, that has some sort of religious significance, does it?
It does, funnily enough.
No, it doesn't. Fuck off.
It does. 666 and the six demons of hell, which we find out later is what she's actually possessed with. In fact, in a minute, we'll find that out. So she jumps out the window like Blade and she runs off to the barn and they all run down and chase her and corner her into the barn. Now, all the way through, the Father Moore's been demanding that she tells him the name of the demon, or the demon tells him his name. And this is something that in the exorcism rite or in any religion, to expel a demon, you need to know what demon you're removing. And in the Catholic faith, Christ still has power over demons because they were once angels. So by the priest using the power of Christ, he can compel the demon to share its name and then expel it. That's how it's meant to work. The demon gets more and more angry every time he asks for its name and starts counting to six and then loses its shit and goes, names.
It's like, German. Yeah, this is weird.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 names, not name. And the priest's like, oh shit. And it's a bit where it pans to Father Moore when he realizes the six demons, and his oh fuck reaction on his face is brilliant. The, oh, I'm a bit out of my depth now.
I missed all that. I didn't not miss it because I watched the film, but I thought she said she was certain herself or himself.
No, so there was six demons in there. One was Belial, one was Lucifer, and the other four I'll get to in facts because it didn't release all the names. She screams the house down, like this barn. She screams and it's deafening everyone. And it also causes the horses to escape, which knocks down her father. And the priest is shouting, look, get to the dad. And no one does. So the priest abandons the exorcism to help tend to the father. And the exorcism's a failure.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to pick up and ask you about on this situation as well is, this is obviously told from the father's perspective. This is a priest telling his perspective on the stand. There is like massive insinuation where it's like, look, yeah, we got the medical doctor there. And when we was doing the possession, I made sure he monitored her heart rate and things like that. Like, did you believe that? Do you believe that actually happened? Not obviously with the true case itself, but I'm just saying, do you feel like his version of the exorcism was as true to what actually was? Or do you think he was making himself sound better and more like by the book? Because he's on stand for it. Because there is no way we watched the scene play out. It was fucking chaos.
Yeah.
But he managed to remind the doctor to make sure he was monitoring her heart rate. I mean, this is the scene in the barn as well. It's like,
yeah,
horses going everywhere, there's doors flapping, there's thunderstorms blowing through, and he's like, oh, make sure you check her vitals. I'm like, fuck off, man. No way are you doing that.
There's no way that doctor went anywhere near her when she's speaking in two different voices at the same time and claiming to be possessed
by six languages.
Yeah, and being possessed by six demons, one of which she claims is the devil himself. Even if I was the doctor, I'd be like, a vital seem all right. She's making a lot of noise. She's moving okay. I think she's fine. I wouldn't be going to check her, would you?
No, what a fuck. But again, in this scene, props to Deborah Morgan, or Jim Carpenter, if you will. She was phenomenal in this. Like, her performance in this, it just looks so physically demanding on her. And she's just a little woman. Do you know, she's quite a petite little woman. I was like, oh man, that must be so physically demanding for you because this is not done in one take. This must have been like a 2-3-4 day shoot just to get this one scene alone.
I was like,
man, I bet you were fucked after doing this.
Yeah, and you can see in lots of the scenes in this, you can see she looks physically fatigued. I don't know if that's because she's tried to act fatigued or if just because she was knackered because she's been run ragged for 2 weeks of filming.
Most probably, yeah. And I bet that obviously worked in the film's favour because she looked genuinely haggard.
She looked broken. Like, especially in this scene.
That was like makeup and prosthetics or anything. I think she was genuinely done in by the time they got to the final take.
Yeah. So the priest has now given his version of events. And Aaron Bruner goes, we're now going to call the doctor because he's going to corroborate with scientific evidence everything the priest has just said. And the doctor's not there. And she's like, can I ask for a recess? And the prosecutor's like, no, you can't. After what you've just done, like showing us all that, you cannot ask for a recess now. And the judge is like, look, we've digested a lot. And I'm going to now just we'll come back tomorrow because there's a lot for us to take in of what we've just heard. And they have a complete recess. And again,
actually, that's just come to me a moment. Sorry, Paul, to do a back on you there, but they actually play the tape recording in court.
Yeah.
So as he's telling his events, they're playing the events on the tape recorder because he says he recorded the full thing for research purposes. So maybe it was as factual as he was saying it to be.
Yeah, maybe.
Because it's playing out as he's telling it from the tape recorder. Yeah. Because the jury in this moment looked truly horrified by what they've heard.
Yeah, I think
before they call the recess, do the prosecution not question him as well?
The prosecution do, but it doesn't really add anything.
Because they corroborate the fact that Emily Rose, he basically tells the jury that she can speak all of the languages that you have just heard. She has not necessarily expert, but she has a vast knowledge in German.
She learned German, she learned Spanish, she was learning Latin. She had access to people who knew Latin.
Latin and like very ancient languages and stuff that she'd learned through like classes in the church and stuff like that. So there was like, don't be fooled by all of this foreign tongue that you're hearing. These are all languages that she has access to. And then he also goes in to explain how the human body has two vocal cords, which I did not know that I could do two vocal cord noises.
No, nor did I.
So this to me was like really cool information that it was telling me on screen. I was like, that's amazingly cool stuff if it's real.
The thing is though, when he pulls him apart, you can keep seeing Erin Bruner. She's almost smirking because she knows she's got a doctor to come in 2 minutes time and just shoot all this down. So she's like, cross-examine away. Tear him apart as much as you want because in a minute, I'm walking out of here and I've won.
Yeah.
But
that's not how it pans out.
No, the doctor doesn't turn up. And she goes out to try and find the doctor. So she goes out. As she walks out, the doctor stood outside and he's I'm really sorry. Tell the father that I can't help him. I admire him for facing the demons, but I can't do it. And then he stares behind her like he's seeing something. And all the way through, the father's been saying he sees a demonic figure. And I instantly assumed, well, he's obviously seeing the same. And he backs into the road. And gets hit by a car. Great. Yeah. He goes through the windscreen as well. Doesn't just bounce over it.
No. Yeah, he goes right through.
I appreciated that they put him through the windscreen and not just over it because it shows how hard he got hit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he gets killed.
And undeserving as well, because I liked him. He was a nice guy. He was very innocent in the whole situation.
Yeah, I liked him as well. Her boss rips her a new arsehole when she gets back to the office. He's like, I told you not to put him on the stand. You wanted to get partner. That is not happening. And I'm telling you now, if you put him on the staff again, on the stand again, I will fire you. The church is furious because the church is paying for his defense. You've made them look stupid. You've made him look stupid. You've made us look stupid. He's like, do it again and I will just sack you. It's that simple.
I didn't understand the anger behind this because I didn't think he did necessarily a bad job on the stand. Even after the prosecution came after him and cross-examined him, I still felt like it was...
Yeah, but it's one of those, isn't it? If your boss tells you no and then you go and do it, you expect to bollock him for that. And if there was ever a case like this in real life, there is no way the church would want a priest sat on the stand saying, yeah, the church signed off on this. They said this is okay. The church, yeah, this is how we do it. The church doesn't want that sort of press. That's bad press for the church, especially when a girl's died, a 19-year-old girl's died because of it. So I can understand why everyone's a bit annoyed. She goes to visit Father Moore, who convinces her that really quick as well, convinces her that Emily's story is far more important to tell than any consequences that he may face or that she may face. And there's lots of questions with belief, and I'm going to go into some of the subplots when we finish going through the run through, because there's lots of subplots that go on with Aaron in particular, and the judge and other people. There's things that if you really pay attention, you know where this case is going before we even get there. She puts Father Moore back on the stand, and as she does, her boss just walks out of the courtroom.
I really like this. That was cool.
He takes the stand and he reads a letter that Emily wrote him the day after her exorcism, in a moment where she was free of the demon.
Because the exorcism failed.
Yeah, but she didn't die. So the demon will not be with you all the time. Like if any possession movie, the possessed is not possessed like constantly. The demon will give you moments to be yourself. And the reason
for the Exorcist, though.
No, you don't. But in most actual demonic possession cases, if you read up on them, the way the demon will do it is it will torment you and harm you and basically, let's say, for example, make you do something bad, like really horrible to someone, like a family member. And then the demon will just disappear into the back of your mind and let your conscious return and suffer the consequences of what you've done, because it will feed on the pain and the suffering you're feeling.
Sounds an awful lot like mental illness, to be honest with you.
It sounds very much like mental illness. We see Emily wake from her bed and we hear her name being called, and she walks out into the misty fields and we see her body fall to the floor, and then we see her leave her body. Now, the letter goes on to say that she meets with the Virgin Mary, who says that heaven is not unaware of her suffering and she's there now. And if Emily wants to go with no more suffering, the Virgin Mary will take her. But if she's willing to go back and suffer, she can prove to the world that the supernatural world is real. And Emily says that she will stay. And she ends her letter by saying, people say God is dead, but how can they think that if I show them the devil? Really cool writing. Really hokey with the Virgin Mary. It didn't need to be the Virgin Mary. It could have been any saint, angel, or anything. But I don't know why they went the Virgin Mary. I thought it was strange.
Yeah, and I like, for all I didn't agree with this scene in particular, I do like the way that it is shot and translated to screen. It looks really cool. For those of you who have seen the poster of this movie where it's all fog, like Silent Hill with the tree and stuff, that is what this particular scene is from. And it looked great. It looked really good.
Yeah.
Regardless of how daft it was.
We also find out now Emily is marked with the signs of the stigmata from this encounter. The prosecution debunking this is fucking fabulous in his closing argument. So she's marked with stigmata. If anyone knows what that is, it's wounds that mirror the wounds of Christ. So marks on your hands, marks on your feet, and quite often a mark on your side as well. The prosecution goes, Well, that's quite possible. It could very well have been the stigmata. However, it's probably more likely she grabbed the barbed wire fence with her hands as she climbed into the field. It's like, yeah, that checks out a little bit more.
That was cool. And then they show you that scene as well, which was good.
Yeah. The defense closing is really strong. And they're basically saying that this is all mental illness that's just the church has ignored. And this priest has deliberately killed this person by not giving them the chance to get the medical care they need. But I thought Erin's sort of closing arguments were good as well, where she's talking about it's reasonable doubt. They need to prove that he neglected her. And she said, and clearly he's shown that he loved her and he was fighting for her. Whether you believe what he believes or whether you believe she was possessed, he was doing what he felt was best to help a child that he cared for. And was
the
that
thing is
neglectful?
About the closing arguments. Sorry, mate, go on.
And was that neglectful?
Yeah, no, I think the thing about these two closing arguments, which translates really, really well, I found, was how sort of formulated the prosecution's closing statement was. It felt like it was rehearsed and well-written.
Yeah.
Whereas the defense comes across as really heartfelt. She spent time with the father, and you can tell that she's really emotionally invested in this. And at numerous times, you can see her welling up as she's giving this closing statement. And it was probably the best bit of acting we've seen in this entire film from her in these sort of 30, 40 second monologue that she has here. And it was really powerful, I thought.
If you were on the jury, what verdict do you deliver him?
Oh, man, this dude's going to jail.
I'm with you. 100% guilty. No question in my mind. And the jury agree with us. They come back with a verdict of guilty. But they also come back with a recommendation that Father Moore gets time served because he's done about a year, from what I can gather, behind bars already. And without any kind of battle or anything, the judge goes, yeah, okay. You are guilty, but you are a free man. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, time jury's served, obviously. If he only got what? I think, what did they give him for it in the end? What was his verdict?
10. He got 10 years.
He got 10 years?
Yeah.
Oh, and holy shit.
They recommended he would have got 10 years. That was the maximum sentence. And the jury recommended sentence him to time served, which from what I can gather is
about... But he is condemned as guilty.
Yeah, but he is condemned as guilty, which means he's not going to be a priest for the church anymore. Erin is offered the partnership because her law firm sees this as a massive win. Like, the church is great. They've saved face. This is a big win. And she's like, no, you poke it. I don't want it. And we see her at Emily's grave with Father Moore. The quote on the grave is the last thing that Emily said to him before she died. Anyone who's interested, it is actually a quote from the Bible. It's chapter 2, verse 12 of Philippians. If you want to go read it yourself, if you have a Bible in your house. It's work on your own salvation with fear and trembling. Really cool quote. I like it. Subplots in this movie, there are a lot. They are everywhere. I'm going to go through some of them, but not all of them. The idea of putting a man of faith to prosecute a priest and a non-believer to defend a priest, I thought is really cool. And that plot alone is really divisive because in most exorcism movies, they would swap that around.
Yeah.
And I like they done that. There's a locket that Erin finds. So she's having, I think we'll call it a crisis of faith. She doesn't believe, but she's seen some creepy shit in her house and she's woken up smelling burning and she's starting to doubt her beliefs. And she finds a locket in the street that has her initials on it. And when she tells Father Moore, he tells her to wear it and she doesn't. And all the time she doesn't, the case is falling apart. And it's only when she puts it on that the case starts to go their way. And it's on the last day she puts it on, and that's when they get the verdict. And this is the having faith in something and then being rewarded for your faith.
Yeah.
Which again,
I like that really element of it. That was cool, even though it was kind of a little bit forced.
Hokey, yeah.
Hokey.
Did you notice the bias from the judge throughout the trial?
Yes. But again, that was all. I liked. It's so annoying because it just felt deliberate for storytelling purposes. Like, oh, you're against her, so obviously, you know what I mean? Like, it was very forced.
The judge was very heavily swayed in the defense's way. So she will shoot down arguments from the prosecution numerous times. If you listen really carefully when they're talking about who they're going to pick as the prosecution, they mention the judge, and they also mention that she is a churchgoer, and when she sat in the dock, she is wearing a cross. So she believes.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
So she is a believer. So not only are the prosecution trying to convince the jury, they're trying to convince the judge, because she is fully on the priest's side, which, again, really, really cool.
Yeah, but she's still against the defense all the way through the court case.
She is.
She is and she isn't. She makes subtle, annoying digs at her.
Yeah.
Maybe that's because she's not a believer and she's defending the father.
Yeah.
Because even time then they do say every time the prosecution tries to shoot down like new evidence and stuff like that, she always allows it.
Yeah, always.
So maybe it's just a front.
The battle of faith is the story within this, especially for Erin. The battle of faith of whether she wants to believe, but the fear of if she believes in a God and angels, to believe that you also need to accept that if God and angels exist, the devil and demons exist as well. And if you do believe that and you understand that, that is a scary concept, to genuinely believe that the devil and demons are real. That's a really scary concept if you think about it too much.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I won't think about it too much.
No, I didn't think you would. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We're going to be back. We're going to do 3-word reviews, some facts, recommended account. And also, we've got a very fun, incredibly unpredictable game today that could go absolutely anywhere. And me and Mark are both going to play it. So,
oh, excellent.
Let's take a break.
Brought to you by the New Run Podcast Network. Welcome to the podcast.
And then the kids in the 80s win it all.
Woo!
No, because now I don't want you to finish it because you're like, you're wrong. You're an asshole.
You're a fucking idiot.
Welcome back. Make sure you head over to yourunpodcast.com. Check out You're Gonna Eat That Crust, comedy podcast with three friends, just being three friends. It's like just talking about everything, whether it's movies or what they've done that week. It's really, really cool. Check out the other podcast network members there as well. 3-word review. Over on X, Wolfman's Got Fun. Wolfman's Got Fun? Wolfman's Got Nards. I'm mixing his 3-word review with his account name. Blasphemous Family Fun. And that's Wolfman's Got Nards, brilliant, brilliant YouTuber. Terror Cards, Extreme Backbend, and they're a film and collectibles account. Dissect That Film, Scary Jennifer Carpenter, and that's a movie podcast. Over on Instagram, Creature Pod, who's Chunky Larry, who's incredible and very, very entertaining. Best Exorcism Movie. Randomly Eric, who is Mark's arch nemesis and also a super cool book account. Dexter's fucking sister. We've got Old Nerdy Bastard. Debbie Does Possession. And he's actually 1/3 of the You're Gonna Eat That Crust podcast. The Nightclub Podcast. Courtroom Horror. And they're a horror pod. Dewey Pod Monster. Pazuzu's Court Date. And that's Dewey Pod Monster. Again, part of the podcast, a rerun podcast network. And finally, Salvage Horror. Pro Bono Priest, and they're a horror account. Mark, what's your favorite one today?
There was two. There was the Pazuzu's Court Date. What was the one before that? The Pizza Guys? What was theirs?
That was Debbie Does Possession.
Debbie Does Possession. I think that one's my favorite.
Yeah, Debbie Does Possession. Like Debbie Does Dallas, but slightly different.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah, I like that. And obviously, Deborah Morgan. So, yeah, that was cool. I like the little spin on that. That's what I'm going for this week.
Okay, cool. Well, congratulations to them. And now it's time for this.
It's that time of the week. Time for Mark to recommend an account.
Yay! Yay!
So this week's recommended account of the week is the Lawrence Herd. I'm actually going to ask you to take this one more than myself, Scott, because I know that this is something you have a lot more knowledge of than I do.
Yeah.
Something you've shared on your stories recently. So I'm going to give this one to you, even though I've introduced it.
Okay, so the Lawrence Herd is a non-profit organisation that helps and rescues and rehomes animals. So cats and dogs and things like that that would normally end up either homeless or worse, put down. The Lawrence Herd take them in, fix them up, feed them, rehome them. It's a wonderful account. If you like dogs and cats, like just scrolling through their page will just fill you with joy. But they also do really, really wonderful work as well. So if you're in a position to donate or to share their stuff just so they can reach a bigger audience, please, please do that, because it's such a lovely thing. And I love when it's a non-profit. They do this not to make money. They do this because they actually give a fuck, which is so rare.
Yeah, but as with most of these non-profit accounts, they pay for them out of their own funding. So help them out.
Yeah.
Put your money where your mouth is and give them the encouragement that they need to keep doing what they're doing. Buy the pets food, buy medical care for these pets. Help them invest in their social media so they can get quicker access to rehoming for all these animals.
Yeah. And it is something that, like, if you can't afford to donate, because I know times are tough, I'm there with you. You can just do something really simple, like share a post. They've got their own merch. Share one of their merch posts to your story. Just like reach out and say hi, like comment on their post, like their post, just something to boost their engagement so more people find out, because you might not have anything, but there might be someone that you share it to who follows you, who is loaded, who might go, Joe, that's great. I'm going to donate $100 to that. And it's something that's really simple to help something like this. It's just simply share it. It's not hard. So yeah, please.
People don't realize the power of social media sometimes. And as for us with the podcast, when people share our content to their stories, even if it's just a case of listening to this episode, like everybody you follow who doesn't listen to the show will then see that and then maybe think, oh, that looks interesting. I like that movie. I'm going to go listen to what these guys have got to say. It's exactly the same for this account.
I can give you some facts on that. So whenever someone shares one of our episodes, within an hour, we pick up more listeners every single time.
Yeah.
We have a steady flow of listeners, but there is always a little spike, even if it's only one or two, every time someone does that. So please keep doing that. And please, please, please go and support the Lawrence Herd as well. Should we do some facts?
Yes, please.
As we're doing opposite weeks this week, I'm going to let you go in with facts first. Tell us about the real case that really annoyed you so much.
Obviously, that was a bit tricky, wasn't it? Because I didn't actually come prepared with facts.
No, but you do. You do know about the real case.
I do know a brief amount. I say I know an amount. I know a little bit about the real case of this after watching this movie and seeing the opening title card saying based on a true story. I then got my curiosity piqued afterwards and I went and did a little bit of digging. I don't have any notes in front of me regarding the fact, so I'm going to just keep it bare bones.
I've got some notes. So as you start going through, I'll give you some information.
Oh, so can you give me the name of the actual Emily Rose character? Do you know what?
Yeah, it was Annalise Michael.
Annalise Michael. That's it. So this is a true case in a certain degree. This actually happened, but this poor young girl who is supposed to be Emily Rose in this movie was performed an exorcism on 64 times.
Yeah.
64 times before her death, she was suffering excruciating pain at the hands of this priest. She was starved and her cause of death was starvation. It wasn't neglect. It wasn't through any trauma she induced during these exorcisms, although they were very violent and she was beat regularly. And some of the court, one thing that this movie did where you see the court case photo of the actor Jennifer Carpenter, where she's all beat up and scratched and cut and all her teeth are all smashed in. That is actually a replication photo of the actual crime scene photo from the true case.
Yeah.
Just so when you watch this movie and you see that photo in the court trial, just know that this is about as real to life as it gets when you're watching it. This poor girl was violently beaten, starved to death, performed an exorcism on 64 times before she ultimately died at the hands of her abusive situation. Now, one thing that incredibly annoyed me about this movie is when you read the facts on the real case of what actually happened, it is clear neglect and violence that was inflicted upon her at the hands of the church.
Yeah,
and this movie depicts them in such a positive light, and they miss out so much in this movie. The actual true case of this story is so horrific that it's a horror movie within itself. And the way that they chose to depict this to the audience and glorify this priest is just mind-blowing to me. It is absolutely disgusting that this movie gets the sort of reputation and credibility that it does based on the true events that actually occurred. Now, if you like this movie, I implore you to go and do a bit of research into the true case that actually happened. And I can guarantee you right now it will change your mind on how lightly you look upon this film.
Yeah, it's the problem with this movie and any movie based on true event. I'd probably argue the Conjuring franchise is probably the biggest culprit for this, is they stamp true events on it, based on true events. But based on true events means something in this movie happened and we can fabricate the rest. And I have
how bullshit it is,
that.
Mate. You could put based on true events at Nightmare on Elm Street. That's how close in comparison these two movies are with the facts.
Yeah, because you could. And stupidly, A Nightmare on Elm Street is actually based on true events.
I know, but it's that loosely based on true events, the same way that this movie is. And it's a downfall of this movie. You should have just not bothered with it. The fact that they're trying to compare the two cases and justify it is criminal.
If they had stuck to the actual case, this movie would be equally as horrifying. And they still could have shown everything they showed in this movie, just depicted the priest as the religious, nasty, I'm not going to give in to this demon, I'm going to starve. They could have made this so much scarier by sticking to the facts instead of trying to make this to appease people. They tried to make the priest out to be the good guy, and in the real case he's definitely not the good guy, not even close to being the good guy.
No, he's an absolute fucking monster. And the problem is that this is a studio production in Hollywood, and it just goes to show you the power and influence that religion has on society today, that even Hollywood is too scared to go up against religion and show how this actually happened and unfolded.
Yeah, so there was two clergymen involved in the actual case. There was a young priest and an old priest. No, I'm kidding. There was two priests involved in the actual case. Sorry.
One was English, one was Irish, and one was Scottish.
Yeah. They were sentenced to 6 months is what they actually got sentenced to. They got sentenced for 6 months. That was suspended, and they'd done 3 years on probation and both went back to practicing with the church, which is
insane.
Unthinkable. To prepare for her role, Jennifer Carpenter spent hours in a room full of mirrors as she tried to work out what different position she could put her body in and what facial expression she could do that was the scariest, which props to her because she nailed it. So
nailed it.
Scott Derrickson wanted to use visual effects for the contortion scenes. And then when he met Jennifer Carpenter, he's like, oh, we're going to do some contortion scenes. And she just went, oh, I can do some of that. So all of those really like twisted body, arms and legs everywhere, no visual effects at all. That is all her. She can bend herself in those positions.
And it shows on screen as well, because as I said to you earlier, there's some of the best scenes in the movie.
Yeah. Did you notice the purple glow?
No. Should I have?
There is a purple glow on screen every time something paranormal is about to happen. So sometimes you see it in a window, or you'll see it like through a door, but there's like this really like almost like goofy bright purple glow. So like the most obvious one is when Emily runs out into the mist at the end, as she opens her door, when she closes the glass door again, there's a purple glow through the back of it, and it fades away as she goes away from the house. I don't know why.
Cool. No, I didn't notice that. No,
I don't know why they've done it.
Does that happen when the defense attorney does, when she's dealing with her stuff in the morning? Does it occur then as well?
Yeah, it occurs then. So literally every time something paranormal happens, there is a purple glow on visual something. Cue. Yeah. The doctor who got hit by the car, in the original script, he was meant to have a heart attack, which is what Scott Derrickson wanted him to do. He wanted him to have a heart attack in the courtroom. So he was going to testify and then collapse in the courtroom and die. The studio overrode that decision and said they needed something more dramatic and impactful because people would not find a heart attack believable, which is just mind boggling.
The script, though, doesn't it? That's what I was saying to you earlier. Like, that studio interference then just backed up my theory that you can't justify this as not being exorcism.
Yeah.
So, had you gone into the courtroom and he'd had a natural heart attack, you could have been like, you could have shown it on screen in a way that it was done by the demons and they'd been gone into shock from what it visualized in court.
Yeah,
but then at the same time, you could have been like, no, he's just an old dude and had heart problems, had him smoking throughout the film or something like that, and then have a heart attack.
Yeah, exactly that. But they didn't do that. The exorcism scene where Father Moore is in the barn and he's drawing the demons out, we get two of the six demons. So you've got Lucifer, Beniel, and the other four only say the names of the people they possessed. So the other four demons is like, one of them goes, I was the one who possessed Judas. I was the one who possessed Michael. I was the one who possessed so-and-so, but they don't reveal the names. Lucifer, as everyone knows in Christian faith and Catholic faith, is the devil. Beniel is, I try to think of the best way to describe Beniel. They're a demon that preys on vanity and pride. So they will basically make men behave in proud ways, which is effectively as a sin, and they'll make women behave very vain and be very concerned about their appearance and things like that. The other four demons would have been the other four demons of the six demons of hell. There are six demons of hell, and I can't remember all of their names, but yeah, that's what they were. It was the six demons of hell that possessed her, so she was never getting unpossessed.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. Is one of them actually the influence of vanity? Is that like a thing?
Yeah. Yeah. So the demons of hell link to the deadly sins. They get you to commit the deadly sins. And Lucifer covers fucking everything. So like if you really read into like the mythology of demons and how demons will influence you, it's not in the ways you would think. It's not demonic possession. It's little things like you're short to pay the rent and they'll tempt you to gamble to get some more money, or they'll tempt you to drink when you're down. It's that's like the true understanding of a demon. Religion is a way of understanding your inner demons that we all battle with.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I think it's all fantastic stuff. It really is. And it's really, really enjoyable read. I've read the Bible. I'm well-versed in the Bible. I'm not an expert in it, but I like mythology. I like Greek mythology most of all. I love reading about Greek mythology and gods and all the rest of it. And I like the Bible for that aspect as well. But it doesn't mean I believe any of it. I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan. Give it another 10,000 years and the world's been extinct. Someone's going to roll across a decrepit book of the Lord of the Rings, going to take it as gospel. It's that kind of level of intelligence for me. Like, I like it based on the stories and the mythology and the world building that comes from it.
Yeah,
but it is a story.
I 100% agree with you. And if anyone doesn't, and you do believe in God and you believe in demons, that's great. That's for you. I don't.
Of course it is. I think it's great. I think it teaches important life lessons and values that more people should incorporate in their daily life.
Yeah.
You know, it teaches, let's be honest, it was all put in place to start with to keep people in line. That's the whole point of it. It's there to keep order and make everybody behave in a certain way, which is mutually respecting to everybody else, and put fear in people to prevent them from doing bad things and prevent them doing murders and rapes and everything else. That part of it is great. And I feel like there's a lot to draw from it and valuable lessons that everybody should at least have knowledge of and take in to a certain level. It's just when people take that little bit too far that annoys me. That causes world wars and mass destruction for other people.
Yeah, and the stupid thing is, like, I still to this day, I don't mention it very often now, but still to this day, I get religious accounts that message me. Still.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, as well, this is it. Like, I know this is going to sound like I'm proper against religion. I'm sending my daughter to a religious school because I think it's an important lesson for her to learn. I think it teaches incredibly important values within children. My daughter's going to a religious school for that reason. So she can learn those values and she can make up her own mind. And if she chooses to expand upon it and become a religious person as she gets older, that is her free will to do so. I will never tell her that that is wrong or right. And I think it's important that everybody learns it. So it's like, don't come at me and be like, you hate religion. You're the worst person in the world. Like, trust me, I'm sending my daughter to religious school so she can learn the values that I feel are important to learn from this stuff.
Yeah.
But just know that it is. You know?
I'm gonna take this one for the team. I hate religion. I grew up religious. My children do not go to religious schools. There you go. You want to come at someone, come at me. All the religious accounts do anyway. We're going to try a brand new game today called One Word Possessed. And I'm going to be playing with you. So how this is going to work is you and me together are going to write a letter from the demons to the priest.
I'm lost already.
And the way we're going to do this is we're going to say one word each. So I'm going to say a word, for example, dear, and then you're going to carry on with the next word. We're going to do this until we have a letter, and there's going to be a letter from Lucifer to Father Moore.
Right, okay.
So this is going to go one of two ways. Either this is going to be really funny and really successful, or we're going to produce the worst written letter in the history of letters. Do you want to go first with the first word, or do you want me to kick it off?
No, you go first. Come on.
Dear.
Father Moore. Can it give me
that's two words. One word.
I know, but like...
No, just... one word. Just one word. We'll start again. Right. Dear.
Father.
Arsehole.
I.
Am.
Coming.
To.
You.
When.
The.
Church.
Let's.
Gaze.
Open
swimming pools.
Four.
Recreational.
Lubricated.
Purposes.
Please.
Do.
Ensure.
That.
All.
Bathers.
Wear.
Dog collars.
You could have gone with a Baz Luhrmann quote there and got on the sunscreen thing.
Go on, we'll keep going.
Where are we at? Is it me?
Yeah.
However.
I.
Insist
that
you
don't
touch
children.
You always end it on a way where I have no comeback for this. In
the
do I do it? In the bum.
Yours
sincerely,
Satan. I have no idea how that sounded or how that
my
came
face
out.
Hurts.
Let us know, is that a feature that should return or is that a one and done? Roundups, I'm gonna go first this week. This is this is my wheelhouse. I love this kind of horror. it, let's take religion and put it on trial. And in this movie, they literally do that. There is a lull in this movie about midpoint, but the same could be said for The Exorcist and most possession movies. You need that lull to further impact the fear of the actual exorcism. The movie is wildly inaccurate to the events that actually played out. And it annoys me that they didn't stick as close to it as they should have done. The religious concepts and fear that surrounds belief, I always love, is something I think should always be played with in paranormal horror. It casts doubt onto mental illness, which I didn't like, because I think that should have been the focus of this, that the mental illness was the real thing and the possession was not. My main takeaway from this movie is the performance of Jennifer Carpenter. She is fabulous, not only showcasing how good she is as an actress, but also how she portrays a really strong female character in horror. Like, all the way through, she is determined. Even when she's possessed, she's given the option to end the suffering, and she doesn't. She stays for the greater good. And that's something that not many characters in horror do. And I think it's a really commendable thing that she doesn't get enough credit for this movie. I love this movie unconditionally for the things it plays with and how it plays with them. Visual effects haven't aged well, but beyond that, it's well built. It has a thought out and developed possession process, and it's a little predictable at the end. It's a 4 out of 5, and it loses marks for not being as accurate as it should, and for kind of knowing where it's going. It kind of steers you too much into this is where we're going, and I think they needed to leave it a little bit more ambiguous, but I love it. It's a 4 out of 5 from me.
Cool. So it's gone. For me, I'm going to start with the positives before I go on to my negatives. So the positive for me is I found the casting to be pretty exceptional. I thought everybody gives a great performance, especially both the prosecution and the defense attorneys, now that I remember their names. Standouts obviously being Father Moore and Jennifer Carpenter. Brilliant actors, both of them. Father Moore in particular, I don't feel like this is one of his strongest roles, but he is an incredible actor in Hollywood. I think the pacing is done really well, something that we've mentioned earlier regarding the back and forth in flashbacks and then coming into the courtroom stuff. Really, really good. I always find myself really drawn to courtroom dramas anyway. I find them to be quite suspenseful. The way they play out, the back and forth, is always really insightful to me. And this dives into some really cool elements with that, with the scientific side of things. Where it falls apart, especially for me, is the forcefulness to show the possession at the forefront rather than, as you mentioned, leaving it as ambiguous as it should have been. It just felt too heavy-handed in a certain direction, and that compromises the overall setup of the way that the story is playing out. You're supposed to go through this being unsure, but I feel like this is maybe due to the hands of studio interference to have more action scenes and more scary moments throughout, that it, in doing so, it compromises a lot of the ambiguity throughout from both sides. Again, that also leads me to the fact that it shows too much influence on the other people involved in the case, which is the defense attorney and the doctor who was initially supposed to be called up. Their influence and involvement in the case, seeing the possession elements and seeing the sort of supernatural interference, takes away that unknowing, because it's too drip-fed to you to say, well, if they're feeling it, then obviously it can't be mental illness. But it also at the same time implies that it is mental illness to the audience throughout. The showing of the Catholic Church in such a positive light and as being a carer and a provider for Emily throughout this is just shockingly, shockingly incorrect when you learn the true story that this is supposedly based on. However, it shows no comparable qualities regarding its plot at all. And if anything, knowing what I know now about the true case has just made me so angry towards this film that they chose to do this and then still have the based on a true story element put at the beginning of the movie. Like, if they were so faithful to the true case, this would have been called The Exorcism of...
Yeah.
What's I can't remember her name again. It's already gone. But the fact that they are so incorrect with their facts and stories regarding the true case is probably why they had to change the character's name in this.
I can't see the family signing off. I can't see the family signing off on this movie.
No, I just can't see past knowing that what this story is supposed to be based on and how it is translated to screen is just absolutely shocking and unforgivable, in my opinion. That is not really why I dislike the movie as much as I did. I just feel like there is a lot of elements throughout this with the forcefulness of your perspective on the story. And it just, as well as I keep saying that the pacing is throughout in certain places, it just hits that point where it gets a real massive lull within the courtroom stuff. You get these real insightful moments where that certain doctor came in. She was brilliant and really caught my engagement. Cool. And then you just get massive lulls in between for long periods of time. And I'm like, oh, God, this just needs to pick up again. And I don't really know where to go with this because there's a lot of stuff in this movie that I really liked, but I'm just so hindered by knowing what I know now after watching it that I can't justify anybody gives this movie the time of day. I think it's insulting, disrespectful, and just downright awful, really, the way that they've tried to showcase these true events in the light that they have in this movie. It's a 1.5 out of 5, and I'm giving it that score based on the performances of the cast, especially the priest, I can't remember the actor's name, and Jennifer Carpenter. And there is still some interesting elements in here. It should have just not had anything to do with the true story, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. We don't have to. We don't have to.
I just find it really, really hard, and I feel like I know I'm being overly critical of it for those reasons. But I can't. After watching this and then going onto Google and reading the accounts of what actually happened in this story, it just maddens me, man. It really does infuriate me to see the way that they played the Catholic Church in such a positive light after knowing what they, because they had to allow this exorcism to this poor little girl in the first place.
Yeah, they did.
Come across as the heroes within this movie. It shocks me, man. It shocks me to my core, and I just think it's an awful movie. And I think anybody who does enjoy this movie on that level, I implore you to go and read the true case that's involved with this story.
Yeah, I know the true case. I enjoy this movie as a movie. I have to remove the based on true events out of my head when I watch it because it's not based on true events.
The studio should have done the same.
Yeah, I think they should have done as well. If anyone is interested, I don't know whether you are or not, the actual recording of the exorcism, the actual exorcism, is available. You will find that really easy. So if you want to listen to, it's not a nice listen. But if you do want to listen, all you need to do is search for audio recording of the exorcism of Annalise Michael, and you'll find it really, really quick. So it is available.
But the thing is as well, like that is... We know ourselves that's not an exorcism. That is just a poor young girl being tortured. Why is that public access?
Because it was in a public court trial and now it become public information. No different to clips of Amber Heard saying, I stepped on a bee. It's as soon as something goes into the public domain, it's available to everyone.
Oh, man, I know, but that is genuine torture being inflicted on that poor girl. Nobody should need to listen to that. That would keep me awake for months on end. I would never want to hear that stuff.
Yeah, which is why you're not the co-host on True Crime, because some of that shit keeps me awake fucking lots.
Yeah, I can imagine it does, man. This is the thing everyone always says to me all the time. Like, why do you like horror so much? It's so gnarly. It's awful. The stuff's shocking. You're so desensitized to things. But I'm the same person who has an absolute meltdown if I run over a rabbit or a pheasant on the road and don't sleep for a week. You know, I can appreciate that that is art in its form and it is all effects and storytelling. But when it comes to stuff like this, where I know that there is a true case behind this story, it just really gets to me more than anything else I would ever watch. You could put me in front of the Human Centipede 10 times over, and I would still be more infuriated by this film than I was that.
Why did you say that? That's getting polled. Anyway, next week you won't have to worry about it linked to a true story at all. We're going to be back with a brand new episode and our first guest of the year, YouTube royalty Barry of Wolfman's Got Nards.
We got Dave on.
God. He will be joining us for a review and taking on the 2 years unbroken Broken Spirit. And I've got to say, he's probably one of the few people I could think at the top of my head who've got a chance to bust it.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a top contender for this. So should we take bets?
Let's bet on Barry's misfortune. I'm going to say Barry's, he's going to get to 12 and dip out. He's going to get to 12, he's going to walk away. Yeah.
Ooh. I think his ego will get the better of him, and I think he'll go further. I think he'll get top. Or he'll get to question 15 and maybe get it wrong.
That's soul destroying. I've done that.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah.
The question in hindsight, I knew the right answer to as well.
And the same for me. I gave you the right answer, then changed my mind and backed out.
Yeah, you did. Well, maybe you can join our club.
Yeah, that's next week. But until then, you son of a bitch, I'll give you something to remember us by. And Mark has no context to that because he's not seen it yet.
No. I will. I'm up to
four. Don't say it because, yeah.
I'm not going to say it. I'm just saying I'm up to four and I have like two movies to watch in order to get caught up for next week.
Okay. We'll see you all next week.
See you next week, guys.